thank you all for coming this evening. And if this were another paper, I could say some interesting things, at least I think they're interesting, on the reliability of eyewitness testimony on historical events. Evidently, what Lucky Luciano had to say about Thomas Dewey should be taken with a grain of salt, as I would argue so should Roy Cohn's testimony about J. Edgar Hoover. But I can give you an example a little bit closer to home. I really thought that you'd be watching clips this afternoon of Cagney and G-Men, Jimmy Stewart in the FBI story, and Johnny Depp in Donnie Brasco. And if you had asked me a week ago, Powers, did you order a VCR for this room? I would say, yes, of course I did. I remember distinctly doing that. On the other hand, I also distinctly remember registering for this convention and getting a hotel room, and I didn't do any of those things. And all I can figure out is that these things would have cost me a certain amount of energy, and so I preferred to believe something that would save me all that energy. I've also heard that referred to as a brain fart, and I think that perhaps that's what I suffered from. I had to say that since we're being taped, and I think it'll enliven the whole enterprise. The popular culture history of the FBI is, by this time, enormously complex. In fact, I would say that it almost defies interpretation, although I think that an attractive and intelligent audience like this could probably interpret it very well. Let's see. During the 19, and I, what I'm going to do is go through three classic phases of the FBI formula. I'm going to start out with the classic G-Men movie with Jimmy Cagney called G-Men, then the FBI story starring Jimmy Stewart. And then I'm going to discuss a darker side of the FBI formula, perhaps best encapsulated in Oliver Stone's JFK and Nixon. And then I will finally arrive at some unexpected recent developments. And I think that when you write a symphony, you're eventually supposed to end on the same note that you selected for the keynote. And let's see if I can do that. I've never written a symphony. I don't think I will. But if someone is rash enough to give me an advance, I think I'll probably promise to. During the 30s, you had a phenomenon that historians have called a cultural depression. Actually, only one historian has ever called it a cultural depression. It's me. But it's a very good term, and I wish other people would adopt it. And the symbol in Hollywood of this cultural depression was the Public Enemy. And the classic examples of the Public Enemy movie were Little Caesar, starring Edward G. Robinson in 1930, and then followed by that a year later, James Cagney in The Public Enemy. And these movies caused a great deal of concern, I suppose, in the public, but of course the public doesn't write anything, and among the moralists of the society, they were certainly very concerned. And they responded in two ways. They felt that the America that was portrayed in the gangster movie was one that really threatened to become a reality. And so they, as Americans will do, decided that they should eradicate the messenger. And so they decided to persuade Hollywood to censor films like that. In other words, to enforce the production code, which had already been enacted but hadn't really been enforced. Secondly, they began to suggest remedies for the perceived crime wave throughout the country. And the public began to respond to the Herbert Hoover administration's reluctance to take on national crime by suggesting that, number one, there should be new federal anti-crime laws, that there should be new prisons to put public enemies in, and that there should be a new super police force on the federal level to take care of the problem. The Roosevelt administration, I think more or less following the curve of public opinion and also seeking to differentiate itself from the Herbert Hoover administration, essentially adopted this, so what I would call a grassroots anti-crime campaign. and in the years 1933-1934 began to enact new federal anti-crime legislation to establish a super prison in San Francisco, Alcatraz, for public enemies, and then to designate the Bureau of Investigation as a new federal super police force to go into war against the public enemies. And this took place with great notoriety and great success in 1933 and 1934. Hollywood saw itself in a position of having a potential gold mine to exploit the fantastic interest in the new federal detectives and the federal war on crime, but the production code kept it from making any more gangster movies. And so taking a cue from the chiefs of police, who said that Hollywood should stop portraying an unfavorable image of the police and should get on the police side, the Hollywood producer said, you know, it'd be a wonderful patriotic thing if we started making movies about the G-men, and can we have an exemption to do it? And they did. And so in 1935, the only real action gangster movies America could see were a series of G-men films starring FBI agents at war with the underworld. The most famous and the movie that had the most impact on public opinion was the 1935 Warner Brothers release G-Men, starring the same James Cagney who had been in The Public Enemy 3 years before. And this movie had such, because it was really the first, had such an impact on the way popular culture viewed the FBI that it really would repay us to review that film and some of the things that happened in it for a few moments. James Cagney played Brick Davis, who is a young lawyer who joins the FBI when his law school roommate is gunned down while on a bureau assignment. Now, for character definition, the movie took some old Hollywood cliches and reworked them in ways that would become permanent fixtures of FBI movies. There's going to be tensions between the job and romance. The demands of his FBI work are going to put strains on his love life. There's going to be conflicts between Cagney and the by-the-book FBI superiors, who are really irritated by Cagney's bravado. And this is the old square peg in a round hole stereotype, which you'll find, I think, almost in any American movie. And then Cagney has to learn himself the value of methodical procedures and teamwork. So you have that clash between individualism and the team. When the movie was over, G-Men had given the country a new breed of action heroes, college-educated cops armed with science and organization, as well as machine guns. The FBI film then added something new to those relatively well-known cliches that I've just talked about, and that is a semi-documentary aspect where you have a self-consciously historical, mythic approach where the movie retells a national experience of significance to the entire society, so that any G-Man adventure has that national war on crime in the background, in the same way that even an inconsequential cowboy movie of the 30s or 40s and 50s will have in the background, maybe more implicit than explicit, the myth of the winning of the West. So a G-Men film will tour the FBI laboratories. It'll customarily look through microscopes. You'll see some fingerprints. Maybe you'll see some ballistics tests. And you'll have some physical training on the part of the agents, jiu-jitsu, you know, oriental dirty fighting, trick marksmanship, the whole repertory of tricks that the FBI agent should have. And all of those features became really obligatory parts of FBI movies throughout the rest of that so-called G-Men cycle of 1935 into 1936, when the window of opportunity slammed shut. The British censors complained that we thought you really meant business when you were going to get rid of violence in the movies, but instead you have all of this G-Men stuff. We don't really care that Hoover and the FBI has defeated public enemies, cut it out. And so that ended the G-Men cycle. And throughout the rest of the 1930s, the 1940s, you had occasional recyclings of the G-Men movies, but became more and more perfunctory. It's a common situation in commercial entertainment that something can continue to be made just because it used to sell, even if everyone involved has forgotten the reasons why it did sell. And that was much the case of FBI Entertainment in the late 40s and early 50s. But around 1950, something new began to emerge in FBI Entertainment. You first saw it on the FBI's own radio show, This Is Your FBI, in which there was less and less sleuthing, less and less action, adventure, heroics, and more a kind of a social worker approach to crime. You'd have a juvenile delinquent, and the FBI agents would try to find out why he was robbing cars or setting fires in the high school bathroom or whatever he was doing. And it would turn out that he had an especially painful case of acne. This is actually one of the episodes, and the FBI agents would just happen to know a good dermatologist, and they'd bring the boy to the dermatologist, and it would be just one more example of how a concerned FBI could help prevent crime. Well, that's a lot different from the way Jimmy Cagney would have dealt with that juvenile delinquent, which would probably be your dirty rat and a punch in the jaw. If the kid was lucky, he'd get a punch in the jaw. Well, that new development in the FBI entertainment reaches its classic expression in the 1959 version of Don Whitehead's best-selling history of the FBI called The FBI Story. And in this movie, Jimmy Stewart played an agent, Chip Hardesty, whose career parallels the entire history of the Hoover FBI. And while it does contain many elements of the classic FBI, of the original G-Men formula, it adds something new, something derived from these 1950s developments. You will still have, and I didn't really notice until I looked at this picture again a couple days ago, you still have a certain element of the square peg in a round hole, but only in the following sense. When Jimmy Stewart goes to work for the FBI, before Hoover takes over, he's a square peg in a round hole because the Bureau is so inefficient and so corrupt. And that irritates him, and he can't get along. But of course, once Hoover reforms it, then he fits in it like the glove that should have fit in the OJ trial. Now, this movie was intended to be a major release aimed at the mass market family audience, and so it had to adopt certain conventions of 1950s popular entertainment. It was going to have a hero who had a family life. It was going to be domestic-minded. And, in fact, what Mervyn LeRoy, the director, did was to adopt the most popular convention of the 1950s, and that is the domestic drama. So throughout the FBI story, you have all of the great events of FBI history. You have the Kansas City Massacre. You have the Dillinger Manhunt. You have the hunts for Nazi saboteurs, for communist spies, right up until the mid-50s. But they're always played out as disruptions to the Hardesty family home. Pearl Harbor signals the FBI's entry into World War II, but to the Hardesty's, it means that Chip has to leave in the middle of a high school convocation when his daughter, I think, is going to recite a poem. And so the whole family is in tears, but Chip has to go out and win the war. And you have similar episodes throughout. So always the outside world is a source of disruptions. That is, it disrupts the family circle, and they have to be set right. It's not coincidental that the long-running Ephraim Zimbalist Jr., the FBI on television, I think essentially adopted the same formula, except that you really don't have a biological family for Ephraim Zimbalist or Philip Abbott or the rest of the TV G-Men. You rather have an office surrogate family. And so they sit down, and they're shuffling papers, and they're talking about what they're going to do on the weekend, and somebody, they tend not to be very earth-shaking crimes, but there might be a sniper trapped on in a tower somewhere, and the FBI has to go, and they have to work out a way of capturing him, talk him down, and kind of a peaceful resolution. Hoover wouldn't allow any gunfire on the program for most of its run. And then they would get back to the office, and they would discuss once again what they were going to do on the weekend. So essentially what you had, again, was a domestic drama in which the outside world intrudes just to disrupt it. Well, that formula then would be, I would consider, the second version of the G-men of the FBI formula that we have in American popular culture. Well, then come the 1960s and 1970s, with the J. Edgar Hoover getting increasingly out of touch with American culture, being regarded as something of a national scold. That would be seen rather indulgently. And then in 1971, you had an epical event in FBI history, which was a counterculture raid on the FBI field office in in Media, Pennsylvania, in which FBI domestic security files were stolen and released through kind of left journals. The journal Win had them first, and then they got out into the rest of the media. And Carl Stern, who was a NBC correspondent, noticed a previously unknown caption, COINTELPRO, on them, issued a request for COINTELPRO documents. And in 1973, he got almost everything the FBI had, lo and behold, and was able then to begin to acquaint Americans with a rather comprehensive program of domestic espionage carried on by the FBI. This coincided with a national revulsion against Vietnam, Watergate, and led to investigations of the FBI in the House and in Congress. And the FBI and Hoover really fit the mood for scapegoats of the time. And in December 1975, there was a Time magazine cover story called The Truth About Hoover. And the truth, according to Time, was that Hoover and the FBI had been the enemies, not the guardians of democratic society. In some circles, the FBI began to be blamed for almost everything wrong that had gone, in America since the Second World War. And Hollywood soon began to reflect this view as well. And I think one of the earliest versions of this was Dog Day Afternoon in 1975, in which you have, you know, if you've seen the movie recently, an amazingly young Al Pacino dancing around shouting, "Attica, Attica," a wonderful film. But what happens is that the streetwise New York City cops are on the verge of settling this bungled bank robbery, which is committed so that Al Pacino can get enough money to pay for a sex change operation in his boyfriend, when the FBI arrives and turn the whole thing into a disaster by their kind of by their book Orwellian approach to handling the situation. I don't know if it's a Orwellian or Huxley-esque. I always get them mixed up. Conspiratorial view of the FBI, that is, seeing the FBI as a symbol of a government with no human values, at war both with the liberties of the nation and with the common sense and common decency of the nation, became a stereotype that lasted well into the 1980s and even into the 1990s. And the best example of that, and one that I won't go into any depth because it's so recent, I think most of us know it, would be Oliver Stone's two movies in which J. Edgar Hoover plays a prominent role. I would say only one thing, and that is that many elements of the classic G-Men film show up in JFK. You have use of microscopes, you have courtroom displays, you have all of the scientific razzle-dazzle that was once used as a demonstration that the government was really omnipotent against crime, but now it's used as a way of liberating a public from government conspiracies. So you moved through those three different, I would say, classic versions of the FBI formula to the more recent past. And here I would say that what begins to happen is that for entertainment reasons, producers and directors and writers began to pick and choose different elements of these myths and combine them all in the same film, no matter how contradictory they are. And sometimes this can be done in an entertaining way, sometimes it's a confusing way, sometimes it's an amusing way, but it can be a very creative way. And I would call that the postmodern FBI formula. And one of the earliest versions of this was the kind of pattern-breaking cult television series Twin Peaks. In Twin Peaks, David Lynch took the most famous features of the pre- and post-Church Committee's FBI and reassembled them, reversing the meanings of some of features of the image, eliminating others, and combining them. Special Agent Dale Cooper is a techno-klutz who dispenses with the high-tech gadgetry of FBI legend. In fact, he reverses the FBI's legendary devotion to science, and his obsession with interpersonal relations contrasts with the FBI's rationality and impersonality. Lynch also exploits the dark side of the FBI as a feature of modern paranoia. When backup agents arrive to help the new age-ish Cooper to conduct an autopsy, for example, they reflect the left's nightmares of a Hoover-esque Gestapo, as well as right-wing fantasies of SWAT teams dropping out of black helicopters. Agent Cooper's matter-of-fact belief in magic maliciously recalls the old-time FBI's promotion of science as an irresistible, infallible, even supernatural crime-fighting weapon, as a scientific form of magic. If James Cagney and Jimmy Stewart once wielded their microscopes like witch doctors, Agent Cooper seems oblivious to any difference between the old-time FBI's scientific criminology and his own way of sorting out suspects by tossing rocks at a bottle while reciting their names. In the classic G-Men pictures, the FBI represented the relentless march of science against savage ignorance. In David Lynch's FBI, there's no difference between science and New Age goofiness. The postmodern FBI is at the same time a rational organization devoted to science and a secret society drenched in the occult, America and alternative America, one and indivisible. The Silence of the Lambs is another landmark in history of popular culture, of the popular culture of the FBI. I'll just briefly summarize the impact of this, number one, on the FBI's recruitment of young women, since Jodie Foster's character was so attractive to so many people that it led, by the FBI's own accounts, to a real spike in their number of female applicants. The FBI science in Silence of the Lambs is also the social scientific variety. Of course, it derives from John Douglas's famous theories of criminal profiling. And it's very interesting to me that while the public finds this just fascinating, the FBI, I think, is a little bit embarrassed by it because they have made a strict separation between the hard sciences, which are in the laboratory division of the FBI, and the profiling, which is down in Quantico, along with all of the educators and people that practice the soft social sciences. So maybe a comment within the FBI. There's one more that I wanted to get at here. Ah, yes. Okay. The popular culture image of the FBI that's left the deepest impression on our culture of the 90s is producer and writer Chris Chase's X-Files. The show draws on the entire history of the popular culture FBI for its ingenious plots and characterizations. Its fundamental plot device is a war between the government, that is, conspiracies on the top level of the FBI, and two individual agents who have taken on the job of trying to free both the Bureau and the public from these conspiracies. The two agents reflect the two sides of the FBI's split personality in American popular culture. Special Agent Dana Scully, who has a kind of a Jodie Foster-ish persona in the series, is a female in a man's FBI. She's a trained medical doctor committed to a rational understanding of the world. Her partner, Agent Fox Mulder, is weirdly intuitive, relying on emotions for his sense of reality, obviously derived from David Lynch's Agent Cooper. He's the antithesis of male stereotypes and of the FBI as a scientific investigator. The FBI in X-Files is charged with concealing the government's guilty involvement in illegal operations and experiments, and so Mulder and Scully are the products of murderous plots when they get too close to the truth. You have, then, a possibility now in American popular culture of a director, a producer, a writer picking and choosing from any one of the three classic myths of the FBI and or combining them in unexpected and ironic ways. But mentioning irony, it is ironic that I think the most successful and I think the best of the recent FBI pictures, and that is Donnie Brasco, returns back to the original classic FBI formula of James Cagney in G-Men. Donnie Brasco is the FBI code name for real-life agent Joe Pistone, who lived for years in the mafia families of New York and was on the verge of being initiated into mafia as a made wise guy at the moment when the FBI decided to pull him from the underground. The film departs from both Pistone's story and the FBI legend in some interesting ways to perhaps also give us some insight into what American culture is doing with the FBI these days. First of all, there is a departure from Pistone's story in creating a square peg in a round hole conflict between Pistone and his handlers, which is completely lacking in the book. Pistone describes the operation as a completely seamless integration between himself and his handlers. As a side note on that, you see the same divergence from the historical truth in The French Connection, where Robin Moore's original story shows just a beautifully run investigation with the New York City police force backing up their cops all the way, whereas in the movie it's just a running battle between Gene Hackman and his superiors. There is also a domestic drama, which is a central part of the Donnie Brasco film, where Brasco's wife, played by Anne Hetsch, blows up at the disruption to her family caused by Pistone's undercover FBI work. And in his autobiography, he said, once again, there was no conflict between his family and himself on this score, although it might be a point here of the director seeing something that Brasco didn't see himself, because they did later divorce afterwards, and evidently because of the cases. And finally, there is a conflict between Brasco and the FBI that runs all the way through the film, which is not present in the autobiography, except on one point, and that is Brasco really did want to stay underground right until the final moment when he was pulled out, and he resented that for quite a while. The FBI continues, I think, to be a useful gauge to study American culture. The FBI is never probably going to recede to simply being a garden variety government agency that has a job to do and is measured on whether or not it does it. It'll always be a symbol of how Americans look at their government, at themselves. That has been true for years. It's true now, and I think it's going to be just as true for years to come. Thank you.